The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Now, I'm joined now by author Louise O'Neill. Good afternoon, Louise.
Good afternoon.
And you have a new novel, Idle. Now, you were in here 2 years ago when After the Silence was published, and you said then that it was your favourite book of all your books. So I'm assuming, do you know Before Idle? Is it your new favourite?
I don't know. You know, it's funny because all of the reviews so far, well, I've been told, I try not to read them, but they've said that this is the best book so far. And I feel like that puts a lot of pressure on me now for the book after that.
It just means you're getting better all the time. Could you describe the book to people?
Yeah, of course. So Idle is about an American wellness guru called Samantha Miller. And Samantha is very beautiful and powerful and successful. She has millions of followers on social media. She travels all across the world giving motivational speeches to her girls, as she calls them. And when her new book comes out, she writes an essay about a sexual experience that she had when she was a teenager with her then best friend, Lisa. And the essay goes viral. But then Lisa gets back in contact and says that's not quite how she remembers that night, that her memory of what happened is much darker than what Sam is saying.
Yeah, and as people will be able to even tell from that, some of your own kind of ongoing themes are in there. Mm. But actually, really a lot of the zeitgeisty kind of themes of the moment are there. So do you have the I suppose, the whole wellness industry? So Samantha, I suppose, kind of Gwyneth meets Brené Brown kind of type. And of course, that kind of wellness culture is big business. And I suppose the thing is, largely kind of aimed at women. Mm. And then like a lot of smart women I know, you know, are well sourced in their lives. They seem to get a lot out of it.
I love, like, yeah. I am in the prime position to write Idle because I absolutely love all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, I think for a lot of women, we haven't failed by traditional medicine. You know, like reports would show that, you know, that we're less likely to, I suppose, receive adequate care, and we're less likely to receive adequate pain medication. Let's say even something like a heart attack, like the symptoms show up differently in women, and we're not really told about that. You know, that it's like, oh, the sign of a pain in the chest. But actually for women, it would be a pain in the stomach. So I think that like women have felt, I suppose, maybe drawn towards complementary or alternative medicine because they have felt belittled by, the more traditional forms. And I think Samantha in Idle has really managed to capitalize on that, you know, that she has, I suppose, seen that there's a market for women who want to feel as if, I suppose, that their concerns are being addressed. And she has created this, you know, empire called Shakti, which is, you know, as a little bit like Goop, you know, a little bit a few of those things.
But like, is a lot of it not snake oil? Like,
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I suppose, you know, if you think about the placebo effect, like, I mean, I suppose if something is helping, like, why not? But I suppose, the clue is in the name, you know, it's supposed to be complementary. I think, you know, I just want to say very clearly, I believe in science.
Yes.
I'm vaccinated, you know.
What would you be into on the kind of Goop side
of
things?
Oh my God, everything. Like, I've had everything. Like, you know, particularly, I suppose, in recovery from an eating disorder, you know, angel healing and past life regression and aura readings and hypnotherapy, like everything that Samantha Miller would recommend, right. I would be like first in line, you know, at one of her events.
Okay, but then I suppose, like, I'm kind of surprised at that because, like, you're not exactly complimentary. Like, the subtitle kind of the book is not everybody we put on a pedestal deserves to be there, and I suppose it does get you thinking about that online. Is there a lot of like public moralizing and posturizing people being something they're not, and that actual, do human beings actually live up to that then?
I mean, I suppose what I find really interesting often with, let's say, particularly Instagram, and I suppose on TikTok as well, like, you know, I suppose people are really yearning for the idea of authenticity, you know, that we want these people that we're following to be authentic. But like, the mere act of holding a phone up to your face and speaking into a camera means that you're performing authenticity. And I think some people online are just very good at doing that. And I suppose Samantha is a really good example of that. Like, she's almost dangerously charismatic. And I think she has found a way to monetize all of the most painful experiences in her life. She's found a way to sort of make money from her trauma, from her childhood. And again, you know, she's trying to monetize this experience that she had with Lisa. But, you know, I think Lisa's probably the first person in her life who has said, no, I'm not allowing you to claim the story. I'm not allowing you to tell my story for me.
Yeah, it's another interesting thread you have in there, which is trauma as content these days. It's kind of a thing in the broader culture, isn't it? That my trauma is more than yours.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I do think I suppose I was quite concerned during Me Too that there was a lot of pressure being put on women to share their stories for the good of the culture. And then you often wonder, I suppose, when after people have shared, like, you know, have been very vulnerable and have shared the most traumatic thing that has ever happened to them online, I suppose, when they come away from that, like, do they have the support systems in place? You know, do they have, I suppose, people there to kind of catch them when they fall? And I think a lot of it is to do with, I suppose, often women are not really seen. I don't know. Sometimes I feel like we need to tell these stories in order for people to see us as human, whether that's sexual violence or domestic violence or during the repeal referendum. And I think it would be nice just to be able to be accepted that we deserve, you know, equal rights without, I think, you know, cutting our veins open to show our humanity.
Yeah. And without having to present also in a kind of a victim light.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a sense of that as well, that there is a kind of a just possibly a victim narrative in danger of taking hold if people are all like, if it's all about your trauma?
I think the thing is that if something terrible has happened to you, it is your story and it is your right, I suppose, to tell that story in whatever way you want. And some people do see themselves as victims and other people see themselves as survivors.
Yeah.
And I don't really know if it's our place to sort of, I suppose, tell them how they get to tell their story. And, you know, I think in Idol, like, you know, Samantha is really does not want... It's funny, she's sort of a contradiction in terms. You know, she's saying out loud, I don't want to be seen as a victim, but she definitely has, I think, this sort of quite a strong victim complex. And, you know, what's interesting is, I suppose, is like with her and Lisa, is that they both see themselves as the victim of the other person's behaviour. You know, they both see themselves as being, you know, damaged and hurt by the other person. And I think it's really interesting when you have two conflicting narratives about the same event, about the same memory, like, how do you reconcile that? And I know after Asking For It came out, because that book dealt with sexual trauma, I would often have people approaching me, whether that was at like signing queues or at events or, you know, even on the street, and they would tell me their stories. And what I found really interesting was how many of them said, but I really don't think the other person sees what happened as assault or as rape. And I think there's something so unsettling about that, that you could have two people in a room and when they leave, one person sees what happened in that room as the most devastating thing that has ever happened to them. And the other person might never think about it ever again. Just, it's like they just assumed it was consensual. And I suppose that is what, what's at the heart of Idol, is that you have these two women who were, you know, best friends. They shared this experience together. And, you know, the way in which they look at that, the way in which that event has shaped their lives has just gone in just completely different directions.
Yeah. And Samantha is appalled at the notion that she is not the kind of person who would ever do anything like that. I presume, though, there are hundreds of thousands, millions of people wandering around who think that as well, but who maybe somebody might come up to them and say, listen, by the way, remember that time 10 years ago?
Yeah.
And I think what's the answer there?
It's funny, you know, when you asked me about, did I think Idol was my favourite book? In a way, I think it's probably my most mature book, because when I was younger, maybe I had very definite answers and was maybe quite, I don't know, but dogmatic. But, you know, and I think when you are younger, you're very certain.
Yeah.
And I think when you're older and you have more experiences and I don't know, I think with this book, I think it was it was so complicated, and like the subject is so complicated, and I think that it's just trying to be as nuanced as possible, because, you know, as you said in Idol, you know, Samantha, so much of her sense of herself is I am a good person, and like that really informs who she is as just her identity, the way she moves in the world. And I think a lot of us are like that. We all have, I think, these ideas about ourselves. And if someone came along and said, no, you're wrong, you might think you're a good person, but you actually did this thing to me, which has destroyed my life, or which has, you know, which has impacted me in this, like, you know, really destructive way. And that is threatening to destabilize your sense of self, as it does with Sam and Idol. Like, I think that can feel so threatening. And as a result, Sam will go to increasingly desperate lengths, I think, to protect her sense of self and also to protect her memories.
And you see, it brings us into a tricky area, right? Because if we're saying that, you know, people remember things differently and everything, you do get into the question of, so how do we know which person is misremembering? Mm. And then, you know, we decided a few years ago, we believe victims. Mm. I believe you before you even open your mouth. Mm. But is that the wrong way to look at it as well?
Well, I really think that, like, before I answer that, I really think that, like, if you read Idol, I think that you'll see by the end, I suppose, you know,
in this case, the way
yes,
it plays
yeah,
out.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. I suppose the like, you know, when we talk about believe women, I think that was, I know what you're saying, that maybe it seems a bit simplistic, but I suppose the thing is, the reason why it was so important was because women were so often disbelieved, because victims were so often disbelieved, because often I think, you know, particularly, let's say, if the person who is being accused of a crime is someone that we know, you know, if it's a friend or a colleague or a partner or a relative, it can be very difficult to sort of hold, like, I suppose, that kind of cognitive dissonance, to hold two things in mind, that this person could be wonderful to you in this context, but also could have done something to harm someone else. So I think our inclination is almost to say, this is too awful, I would rather believe that this was a lie. And I think that has been the problem, you know, for generations now, is that victims, and I suppose, you know, when we are talking about sexual violence or domestic violence, you know, victims tend to be women. They can be men as well. And there just has been, I think, this tendency to just say, we don't believe that. And, like, you know, in Idol, I suppose, so much of what the book is also dealing with is memory and how trauma intersects with memory. And, you know, we have seen that, like, trauma actually impacts the part of the brain that collects memory. So people who have experienced this are often, I suppose, the way in which they remember it might not be linear, or it might not be very clear, or might be a bit fuzzy. And actually often that is used as, like, quote unquote, like, proof that they're lying. And I think it just parks back to that tendency just not to believe victims.
Why did you make the abuser a woman in this case?
Okay. Well, I mean, firstly, you know, the whole point of the story is we don't know whether she is an abuser
I beg your
or not.
Pardon. Yes,
yeah, yeah,
yes,
you know,
yes,
but I suppose the person who's been accused of these allegations in Idol is Samantha, who's a woman, obviously. There was two reasons for that. I mean, I think the first reason is that often, and I know this from personal experience, you know, when you're talking about topics such as these, you know, like sex and power and consent, and I suppose the idea that, like, false rape allegations are, you know, are very common in society. When you're trying to have a conversation about that, it can often descend into this really messy argument about feminists hating men and you know, and like that, and misandry, and, you know, all of these things. And actually, I wanted to have, like, a very clear-eyed view of this. And I wanted the reader to have that experience as well, so we could just look at, I suppose, the topic in and of itself. And having both protagonists be women felt like the easiest way to do that. And also, you know, Sam and Lisa in Idol, like, I suppose I really wanted to explore, like, this obsessive teenage relationship.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, for me, I suppose, you know, having had been a teenage girl, oh, God, like, those relationships, the hurt that can be done at that age really stays with you for the rest of your life, you know. And the tragedy of this is that even though Sam and Lisa both think that the other one, as I said, has hurt them in ways that they will never recover from, they are actually the loves of each other's lives.
And is that a common thing with teenage girls, that it's verging on it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and it was funny with my first novel, Only Ever Yours, which also has sort of an obsessive teen friendship at the heart of it. So many people read that as queer. You know, they were like, they thought that they were. Yeah. And I was like, oh, no. I mean, people can read the book in whatever way they wanted. But from my perspective, I thought, no, just when I was that age. Oh, I had a teen breakup, like a friendship breakup when I was about 17. And honestly, I don't think I've ever been as hurt when a romantic relationship broke up. It just broke my heart in two. So I think that does stay with you.
Yeah.
And you can, as I said, like, you know, with Sam and Lisa, they haven't seen each other in 22 years when Sam goes back to her hometown to confront Lisa about these allegations. And they're still just irresistibly drawn to each other. They just can't, even though it you know, is going to result in their sort of mutual self-destruction.
Yeah.
They just can't help themselves.
And there's an element as well of that, those kinds of intense teen girl friendships can be maybe a bit toxic, a bit exclusionary of other people at times and stuff as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, I mean, when Samantha Miller is involved, things can get a bit toxic in general. My God, she was so much fun to write. Someone described her as Patrick Bateman meets Anna Wintour. And I just thought that was just perfect. Yeah. She's sort of like a supervillain, you know, this, as I said, someone who's so charismatic and charming and really used to getting her own way. Like she won't take no for an answer. And I think for Lisa, who's always sort of just been in her sway, you know, I think it's just very hard, even as an adult, for her to say no. Appropriate boundaries, please.
And yet she gets kind of more or less cancelled, I suppose you call it. And you feel a bit sorry for her. And I almost thought, you were a bit sorry for her too.
No, listen, excuse me. How dare you? As the author, it is not my place to feel sympathy or not.
Okay. Is there a certain sympathy there, though, with people who get their whole thing suddenly torn apart by cancellation?
I mean, you know, it's funny.
Spirals a lot.
I know. I think there's a few things with that. Like, I don't necessarily know if I really believe in the idea of cancel culture. Like, and I'll tell you why. Because often when we talk about cancel culture, like, there are two parts of that, where one, it's like, okay, but is this actually consequences if you are expressing homophobic, you know, racist, transphobic, misogynistic, you know, like if you're expressing really offensive views, then there has to be consequences for that. And then I think often you'll hear, like, you know, celebrities talking about being cancelled while they're like on a radio show or on a TV show or, you know, giving a print interview, talking about how they've been silenced while being given a national platform with which to express their views. But I suppose...
Are people sometimes, though, cancelled because the kind of mainstream of liberal opinion disagrees with them? And then you think, well, we were fairly sure of our morals as well back when we used to kind of cancel women for getting pregnant outside of marriage or all of that.
But we're
right this time.
Well, I mean, I do think if you're talking about someone being racist, like, I don't know, I think when you're talking about, let's say, as you said, women, you know, facing consequences for being sexual, like, when the time and the culture shifted, we could look at that and see that was wrong. I don't think in 50 years time people are going to say, oh, actually, racism was correct. They kind of overcorrected there, you know.
But I do think people can sometimes get in trouble with the best will in the world and that. Are you careful now?
Yeah, I mean, I think Samantha in Idol has like 3 million followers. I mean, I have about 20,000, you know what I mean? It's not quite the same, but I think anyone who has an online following, you know, however small. I mean, of course, no one wants to be called out. No one wants to hurt anyone. No one wants to upset anyone. But I think I have seen that, I suppose, if someone makes a genuine mistake and is willing to say, look, I'm sorry. And I think there is like actual grace there. And, you know, I read this interview that Marion Keyes gave to The Telegraph. And she said that people with long careers, I thought it was so clever, like, it was just so well put. She said, you know, with people with long careers, you know, there's always this fear that, you know, that you would have said things at the beginning of your career that you would rather take a bullet in the head than say now. Mm. And, you know, she said that, you know, all she could say was that she was a product of her time. And now that she knew better, she must do better. And I sort of think that's true of all of us. Like, we're all learning.
If that could be the rule, that would sound like a fair rule, wouldn't it? Of course, the thing is, you can also get a load of grief online for saying good things and saying the right things as well. Like, yeah. I get the impression that you have handed your Twitter over to Richard,
yes.
your boyfriend.
And he's doing a great job. Now, one time he did tweet accidentally from my account about the Bulls, you know, the Bohemian soccer team. So I did have to text him immediately and be like, this is very off-brand. Please take that down. But he's great. It just
Did you have to get out of it?
I did. I left in 2018 and... See, do you know, it's one of those things where, and actually, you know, again, coming back to Idol with Samantha, like it's trying, I think for her, she can't seem to differentiate between legitimate criticism and between trolling. She sort of conflates the two, you know, and I think for me, it was like, I think I could handle legitimate criticism because look, you know, I write a column, you know, you have this program, like there are going to be people who disagree with you and some of them will have really good points and you have to listen to that. But I think when it descends into like rape or death threats or things like that, it just began to feel like very overwhelming and sort of scary. And
had it descended into that?
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, any woman who's online will have had that experience. But, you know, I think what I was glad of was that I could take a step back. You know, I mean, in Idol, there's this scene where after the allegations are leaked, this very sort of grubby, like, you know, board meeting where the head of her company is like, listen, we'll put a vague statement out. We'll make a large donation to a rape crisis center and you need to stay off social media. Just go dark. And Samantha is completely incapable of doing that. Like, she is addicted to social media. She's addicted to the validation, you know, whether that's good or bad, I think. And honestly, not everybody has to have 3 million followers to understand what that addiction is like.
Have you had that addiction?
I mean, when I first quit, like the only way I can describe it, I think anyone who's ever given up sugar or cigarettes or coffee would understand. It was like a constant craving to grab my phone, and even the muscle memory of like I knew where the app was, so like my hand would instantly like go for the Twitter app, I just kind of sort of had to sit on my hands for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then it subsided. But it was in the beginning, I was like, oh god, this is a problem. But I think those apps are deliberately designed to be like that. I think they're deliberately designed to be addicted.
What were you looking for?
Well, for the on my
what
phone.
What were you after, like?
I don't know. I think it was almost the sense of being seen. And I think with time, you know, I mean, I've been off it a long time now, but I think with time, I actually began to realise that it wasn't just the positive reinforcement that I was addicted to, that actually the negativity almost felt addictive as well, because it kind of reminded me of at the time I was still it was a bit before that I was still struggling with an eating disorder, and it actually the energy of it felt very similar in that it's like, this is so bad for me and I hate it but I can't stop. Like the two of them felt very, very, very similar, and it's not a coincidence, I think, that like I recovered and then kind of shortly after I gave up Twitter as well.
Do you think this is the case for a lot of people?
I mean,
like, is this whole thing a massive problem? Like that
with social media?
Nobody should be going near?
I mean, I don't know. I don't want to be too sort of simplistic either, you know, because I think that like social media has been an incredible vehicle for change, you know, and for social justice. Like Black Lives Matter wouldn't exist in the same form or Me Too, but I suppose I think it's about people trying to be in charge of their social media rather than feeling as if that they're powerless or that it has control over them. But like, you know, I'm not a psychologist, so I won't analyze the entire of the Irish population.
No, but it's interesting you say that. Basically, most women will say that they've had those kind of experiences you've had of really, really horrible stuff.
I think so. And I mean, especially, you know, I have friends who are, female friends who are journalists or who are TV presenters. And I suppose, you know, I mean, they get it even worse. And, you know, it's just, I suppose it's something that really needs to be tackled.
Yeah. Well, listen, as people will get from that conversation, the book is, it's like so zeitgeisty and deals with all these tricky areas and all the nuances of it and everything. And it actually is kind of mind bending to try and work through it all. I don't envy you sitting with it for months and months on end negotiating, you know, this stuff.
Yeah, but you know what? I will say, like, I wrote Idol during lockdown, and I found it so like just the topic so endlessly fascinating and engrossing that actually I think sometimes it was the only reason why I wanted to get up in the morning. I was like, okay, I get to go back now to Idol and to the world of Samantha Miller and just tackle this. And I suppose the thing is, you know, we're having a 20-minute conversation. As you said, I spent months writing this, but also trying to tackle it in a way where it's still a thriller, where it's still exciting, where Idol still felt compelling and was a page turner. And yeah, I mean, I hope that, you know, people who read it will feel the same way.
Yeah, it's not a diatribe on a bunch of issues.
Like, it's not. It's
really
not.
You know the way they describe books as unputdownable? It's got a touch of unputdownable. Yeah. You would be anxious to get back to it. Okay, listen, thanks very much. By the way, After the Silence, your last book, there's going to be a movie or a TV?
Yes, well, actually all of my books, there's Conversations About Idol, so that hasn't been yet, but I think all of my books have been bought for screen. I mean, it all happens at such a glacial pace. With Idol, I definitely... Samantha Miller, I'm thinking either Reese Witherspoon or... Would Gwyneth Paltrow, would that be a bit close to the bone, do you think?
No, I think Reese, it's a kind of a Big Little Lies kind
of nice
interiors and all that kind of thing. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, listen, Louise O'Neill, thank you very much. And Idol by Louise O'Neill is published by Bantam Press and it's out now. Thanks, Louise.
Thank you so much.
Email brendan@rte.ie.